You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations peoples' connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT.
Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us. Welcome to Radio MMT. I'm your host, Kevin, and this afternoon we've got Kent with us today. Look, it's normally Anne and Kev, but we've got Kent today who's coming to join us. How are you, Kent?
Howdy, Kev. Thanks for having me on.
No, that's right. It's good. I've done this show by myself once or twice, and I don't like it. I like to have company. It's very hard to talk to yourself.
It's a good thing I ran into you, just happened to run into you outside, and, you know, right a few minutes ago.
Just as you're walking down the street.
That's right. It was like, there's Kevin. Let's, you know.
Get in here. So it's good. Now, we've been going through the MMT 101, starting from the beginning. So the last few weeks, we had discussions with Professor Bill Mitchell, who, of course, is the founder, of the founders of MMT. Yep. So you can't get a better start than that for the season. And we were talking about money, the origins of money, and about fiat currency, and about how the government spends money into creation. That's how where money comes from. But that the government creates money when it buys things. It decides it wants military, it types some numbers into computers, it sends it off to the soldiers and the military supplies, and then you have money in the economy, and you start an economy.
It's amazing how that works.
It is, and people seem quite confused about it. It's really not that not that complicated. Who was it? Elon Musk, when he was working with Donald Trump.
He found the money printers.
He found
the magic money printers.
He found 14 magic money computers.
That's right, yeah. And he told the world about it was it like a Ted Cruz podcast or something?
Yeah, something like that. You go, mate, that's how it's been done forever. Anyway, that's one form of money. And we call that fiat currency. However, there's more than one way to introduce money into the economy. And if we had to simply wait to accumulate enough money that the government spent into the economy through its spending, etc., it might take quite some time to to accumulate that money to buy things like cars and houses. And so there's another form of money.
Especially if Elon Musk is, you know, running your payment system and your fiat currency, public money.
Yeah, correct. So today we're going to speak about another way of accessing money, and we're talking about banking and credit. It took me a while to understand. Yeah.
And it's a confusing thing, but we'll hope to... Yeah. Not confusion on a Friday night chatting about banking money.
Now, this is the challenge. The first half of the show, we're going to spend talking about the nuts and bolts of the banking system, and it can get confusing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of information out there, so we're going to try and steer you through this.
Do not operate heavy machinery while listening.
because like, money seems to be money. If I go to the bank and I loan some money, that to me appears to be the same as other money, and it's supposed to appear the same. And essentially, we could say that it is the same, except that there's different ways of acquiring this money.
And it's a nice thing to have money in this very troubling time that we're forced in, that workers are forced in, and so forth.
You know. Let's just do a little history of credit.
Let's do some history.
Tell me about the history of credit.
Cool. Well, Kev, I think one of the biggest revelations for me was discovering that you know, that money, that this often story we're told about it, difficult to start with the myth first, but it did not evolve from barter, right. Basically. That's the biggest myth to bust of the whole thing. It was because of human societies of our ancient ancestors across the world, and this is similar in all archaeological, anthropological records that we find, is that it shows up as credit. And one of the best examples, I mean, starting out, we have the most evidence of, you know, is from Uruk in Mesopotamia from 3000 or BCE or before. And this was all based on credit. And in fact, the, you know, fun fact, Kev, I don't know if you said this before, but that's actually where the origin of writing came from.
Right. Okay.
It shatters the romantic, poetic notion of writing as a creative sort of expression. But that's the story of it came from accountancy.
Can I give you a little example of this? I had an ex-girlfriend who is an Italian, and her mother was essentially, you'd call her an Italian peasant, for want of a better word.
Okay.
Never
back in the Menacious, Kev. Yeah.
never had much schooling, and never learned to read or write. Came out to Australia. Still has a very strong Italian accent.
Yeah.
Can't read or write, but she can count. Right. So if you're talking about the hierarchy of writing things down and keeping a record of things,
that's what it was.
It makes sense. It makes sense. Yeah. Because nobody wants to get ripped off.
So. No, absolutely. And I think back to the example you started with when Elon, there was a great Stephanie Kelton Troll from Elon Musk, and she put up a picture of a Babylonian clay tablet and said, imagine if the Babylonians found 14 magic money clay tablets that they had in existence. You know, what had happened almost about 100 years ago or so, the people that started to actually look at the archaeological, anthropological records, or who started to try to get into the economic space. I mean, the famous one being A. Mitchell Innes, this British diplomat who was stationed in Cairo, wrote two articles in 1913 and 14 to basically destroy Adam Smith's error. That is the myth of barter.
Right.
That basically he said that credit is money and money is credit, in two articles, from one being 1913, which was really critically looking at the history of coinage, but going back and saying that the earliest evidence of that is Greece and 800 BCE. You know, we've existed in economic transaction, material transactions long before that. Basically, he sort of really compiled all these sort of this milieu that was going around. There's others of and so forth that were writing about this stuff, but he put it in the Banking Law Journal. And I think that's what I'd like to actually quote is one of my favorite heroes, David Graeber, who wrote the book Debt, which is a brilliant anthropological look at how that manifests as social debt, as interpersonal debt, gift and sort of tribute, and all of the range of the sort of the breadth of human experience that we have, and that like the, and how like a myth, the story of barter just destroys all this richness of our human history. But he basically said that Mitchell Innes wrote this, and that he said that basically no other economist actually challenged him. They simply ignored him. So he put out this, you know, basically this treatise of money. And when someone comes out with a new theory, it's like, okay, they need to check that and validate it or critique it or so forth. That didn't happen.
Right.
It was basically just ignored.
Right. It didn't fit their story, so they just pretended it wasn't there.
Yes. Yeah. And Graeber said they ignored him, basically. Right. So, yes.
Like the barter myth says that, people were cutting around oranges and eggs and bays of hail, and it was just easier to create money to facilitate these exchanges.
Right. It was a lower cost alternative, quote unquote.
Yeah, yes, yeah, yeah.
That's the story.
We're disputing that. And what are we? What exactly?
We'll
are we
go
saying
on that? Record for disputing it.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. So what exactly are we saying is the difference? Like, what's the fundamental difference there?
Funny enough, at the time that and this really came from Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations and so forth. That basically, even at the time, and Graeber says this in his book, at the time that Smith writes this, he was going to store credit, and credit would be like stamped on like a leather pad or something like that. It was store credit that he was using. And he dreamt up this like Alaskan cod example, which has been debunked. And Mitchell Innes, in fact, says that he actually didn't discover barter in that situation. He was actually describing a credit system when he said that. So that basically it was going on a form of credit. In that sense, you know, I'm not an expert on that field and this sort of period, but that basically others have said that this is just store credit. There's a store I live around where some people come in and get stuff on credit, and that's how it works. It's just a debt obligation, a reciprocal arrangement between two parties where the one person's credit is another's debt.
Yeah, sure.
That's what it is.
Right.
Yeah.
But I'm still unclear as to how that differentiates from the bottom of this. Because look, the only thing I would say to that is that when somebody says that you owe me this and I owe you that, and it comes in a denomination,
right?
That denomination had to come from somewhere, and that denomination is nearly always government currency. It's created by the government. The government says, "Here's the unit of account." And so when people then have these arrangements of credit and they're exchanging stuff, it's done in a unit of account that it exists, and that unit of account exists because a government brought it into existence. Would that be closer to the truth?
Yes, yes. I mean, and basically, like a Knapp once said, I mean, and this is going back our modern states of, right, what, been around for 200 years or so. The way I think of it, basically, there is some kind of institutional arrangement. And this is actually what Randy Ray says. He says money is an institution, but it's not like it's an institution like a government building, a church, or a business. It's a human social behavior. That's what that means. But there is something that functions that is sort of a collective nature that is inherent to the, you know, the moneyness, say, of a credit debt arrangement.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, one thing to think of, Rowan Gray says, what we have now is such as been a long historical period of now we have stability and we think there are things we have. I can hold a $5 note in my hand. That's a thing I have. And it becomes concrete. That's been a long history to get us to this point.
Right.
Yeah.
But the currency that is being used has its genesis in the state, and as we've discussed in previous episodes, money is used by the state to control behavior more than anything else.
And there's that too. Yeah, absolutely.
So when people have these credit arrangements, this is something which comes after the creation of money by the state to facilitate the utilization of resources amongst its citizenships.
Yeah.
You know, if a government creates a currency, it imposes a tax, people are required to pay that tax, then they will engage in activity that the state wants them to.
It comes back to the example, like the monopoly of state violence. And Warren Mosler says it's a guy with a gun, you know, his famous business card example, gave the business cards out to his kids to do chores. And he said, well, I'm going to collect so many at the end of the week. And that was just like a tax obligation.
Yeah, he attaches an obligation to that, and therefore that card becomes worth something. And it's from this that we get this exchange happening. And it's probably from there that Adam Smith starts his story. But he started at the wrong place. He started late.
Well, he discovered a credit economy. It's basically what Mitchell said is like, he, you know, describes a card that was being transacted or something. And
right. So like, the barter myth, which is the origin story of money, which is widely taught throughout many mainstream economics courses, is based on money being created as a convenience to exchange things of equal value, and yet what you're saying is that what Adam Smith was actually describing was a credit arrangement where there was debt and people owed something to somebody else. It wasn't an equal exchange transaction. It was a debt arrangement.
Yeah, okay, he misrepresented it, and unfortunately.
Right.
You know, we're humans, we do that.
We're talking about banking here, so we're going to get back to
it's
banking.
It's Friday night, Kev.
Yep. Money is created when a government spends it into existence. I always like using the military because nearly all governments have military. It's sad, but it's true.
Yeah.
So the government spends money on its military. It does this by paying suppliers of the military and soldiers and caterers and uniform makers, etc. And all of a sudden we have this money in the economy. We call that fiat currency. Mm. We've dropped gold standards. What's the Latin for fiat?
Let it be.
Let it be.
Yes,
and so it's a value that will find its own balance somewhere.
Like magic.
like magic, you know.
Or not, really.
Well, you know, like a litre of milk could be worth $1 or $2 or whatever. So the economy will figure that out.
That's right. Ask the Prime Minister how much a price, you know,
that's,
milk
that's
costs.
That's fiat currency. Right. If I want to buy a bottle of milk, a litre of milk, it's pretty easy for me to save $1. If I want to buy a fridge to put the milk in, I'm going to have to save up for a bit. That's going to take me a bit longer. If I want to buy a house to put the fridge in, by the time I save up all the money that I can get through the economy, just through the government spending it into the economy to buy the house, I'll be dead before I can save up to buy.
I think that's where the housing market has been set up since the 90s.
Yes. Well, that's a whole other topic. But the point here is that if I want to access this money that the government has created, I have to come by it in some sort of out there in the market, making myself available. The government will send it to a uniform supplier. The uniform supplier will go to the grocery store. I'll be the guy stacking the grocery shelves. The supermarket mm-hmm. will pay me for stacking the grocery shelves, and so it filters through the economy, and I can buy that money, and I buy myself some milk, and then I buy myself a fridge, and then I say I want to buy a house,
and Kevin's happy,
and but I can't afford a house because it's going to take me decades and decades. Yeah. So,
yeah,
this is now where we're talking about bank credit. So I go to the bank, and the bank says we will loan you the money to buy mm-hmm. the house.
Aren't they nice?
Yeah. What? So now I'm not accessing fiat currency. When I was buying the milk, I had fiat currency. When I saved up and bought the fridge, I essentially had fiat currency. But now I want to buy a house and I take out a loan from the bank.
Yeah.
Now I'm accessing bank credit. It seems the same, but it's...
Well, this is where it gets tricky. I mean, really, it is denominated in the Australian dollar. Basically, when a bank makes a loan to you, what really happens is they effectively mark up both your accounts, basically. What that means is basically that credit is created out of thin air. Contrary to all of the neoclassical orthodox myths that it's based on some kind of savings or fraction of that, it is actually created out of thin air when you commit to a mortgage legally.
The common misconception is that the banks accept deposits from people that have acquired fiat currency, and that the people with this money that they've acquired through the economy then deposit in the bank, and then the banks then loan that out again. What you and I have learned is that the two things are completely separate.
What I want to quote to you, Kevin, is so many people in the credit theory of money point to this one article by the Bank of England in early 2014 that they came out and said, and I quote, whenever a bank makes a loan, it simultaneously creates a matching deposit in the borrower's bank account, thereby creating new money. That, and also the common misconception is banks act as intermediaries, as you were describing before, lending out deposits to savers with them. That's wrong. That this money multiplier approach is completely wrong.
So the money multiplier, the deal was that if a bank has $100, it only needs to hang on to 10% of that. It can then lend out 90 as long as it hangs on to 10%.
Yes, and that's called fractional reserve banking.
Fractional reserve, but that's all nonsense as well. Complete bullshit. The essence of it is this, is that all the bank has to do to loan money is to check the creditworthiness of a customer.
That is absolutely,
And so the only...
They're also seeking a profit from you. So they want a profit off you, Kev. Don't forget that.
Part of the creditworthy. So if you want to go and borrow $100,000 from the bank, the bank doesn't have to see whether it has $100,000 in its vaults because that's irrelevant. All the bank has to do is through its statutory obligations with the government to go through a credit check that says, this person who wants $100,000 looks like he's quite capable of paying back $100,000 plus the interest we're going to charge him.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then there's the kicker, right?
Yeah. Quite often the interest is as much, if not more, than the principal. That's their obligation. Now, they don't have to have anything in their reserves.
So, no, they do not. And back to that Graeber thing, I want to make one point on that. The Graeber basically said he rewrote an afterword to Debt in 2014, originally published in 2011, and came back and said when the Bank of England came out and said that, he wanted to pop a champagne bottle because finally he said this is the death of the myth of barter and it's dead and buried.
Right.
But unfortunately, it's sort of dragged on a bit.
Yeah,
I wish he was right. Yeah, so basically they would assess, and there's been so many, issues of this, of like people in casual and secure employment not being able to get loans and having to use the banks as, the one who is supplying an essential fundamental human right, housing, or access to other, if you need an advance, a credit for food. So many people are struggling to eat nowadays and skipping meals and so forth. And that, that basically that, you're paying that back over 25, 30 years.
They're even talking
with
about,
a lot of interest.
They're even talking about loans that go past your lifespan now in some places, I think.
We'll keep paying when we're dead.
This is where I get my nose out of joint a bit.
Right.
Because,
okay. Yep.
Because a government creates the currency, and a government creates currency to unlock the resources and mobilize resources within its economy so that, that roads can be built and houses can be built and people can be fed, etc. This is the purpose of money, and the money is created by the government. Mm-hmm. And what we're saying here is that people can time shift some of their spending decisions, because if it's going to take too long to save up, money will become available through the banking system so that you can purchase these things earlier. But but the only thing that that is required by the banks to facilitate this service is to check the creditworthiness of somebody.
Yep.
And that means that there's a whole bunch of people in our society who are never going to be able to access the resources that they need, like housing.
Or that they deserve and that we all deserve as fundamental human rights, right?
Because they don't meet the creditworthy check. This is something which, for instance, became apparent to me. I'd been paying a mortgage for nearly 20 years with the Commonwealth Bank.
Oh, you're so close, Ken.
And then separated, split up with my partner, and went back to the bank and said, I'd like to take out a loan. And they said, oh, no, you're self-employed and you're pushing 50.
Mm.
You're a liability, mate.
I'd say it's discrimination.
Like, regardless of the discrimination, there's plenty of people like me. The point is that because of the onerous interest requirements that the bank places on just time-shifting a spending decision for something which is like a basic human right, like housing, which ends up with a class of renters paying off the houses for a class of property investors. And the only obstacle is the profit of the banks through their interest payments. The rents they pay could easily pay off the mortgage of the house if they're allowed into that system. But they're shut out of it. If I'm not able to get a loan, I'm now in this other rung down, and all of these things aren't accessible to me. And one of the main things that that we recognise when we take out a loan with the bank, especially for a house, etc., is that the lion's share of the money that you repay is interest that goes to the bank.
Return on equity technically is what they're aiming for. But the fact is, you know, when, you know, such a large institutions, of course, they seek out more power and want to become bigger and look at how's the best way to make more profit, grow, so forth. We know the story. You know, it's a typical oligopoly story.
So let's just say that credit makes up a substantial amount of the economy. But the only people that are able to enter into that arrangement with banks are people who are profitable people. If you're not profitable, then you don't have access to this form of money, which is terribly important.
Which is, I think on the BOE, they put it about like 94 to 97%
authorized. 94 to 97% of what?
Of money in the economy, of what's called broad money. And I think what you're getting at, just to say a technical description, like these are still used in some sense, like the narrow money or basically what are called reserves, called in Australia exchange settlement accounts. That's between the central bank and a private bank who's been an authorized deposit-taking institution, ADI, and then cash. That's narrow money and so forth.
Right.
But then broad money is basically this that banks can create. And that's why that BOA paper was so pivotal, because it really cemented the credit theory of money. And one point I'd say is, like, you think about the what's called the hierarchy of money. I mean, because it's all denominated in Australian dollars, unless you're another country and it's not whatever, but that basically this is also called horizontal because it's within the private sector.
So horizontal money is basically, we're talking about bank credit, and
extends along sort of horizontally on the hierarchy of money. And state money is, of course, the top of that when the government goes into deficit, as we know, that's a surplus for the rest of us.
So fiat currency we call vertical money in broad terms, and credit banking money lines.
It still is denominated in fiat and transferable if it was demanded to be in fiat currency. That's the big thing, and that is frankly something. And you mentioned earlier about the historical record, that wasn't the case. I mean, for a long time, central banks are there to actually provide that as a subsidiary of the government. And that is actually in the Reserve Banking Act. Like, that they are the Commonwealth government's agent. That is their job, basically.
It's the government's bank. The Reserve Bank of Australia is the government's bank. They say it's independent.
I don't think that's a big spoiler alert, hopefully, for many people here. But, like, yes. I might say a bit of a brief story on this. And this is, I really love this chat with Rowan Gray. He's an Australian guy in the U.S. And actually comes it from a legal perspective, because the law is such a fundamental part of this. He gave the example back in, like, and this is in the U.S., apologies for the U.S. and my accent here on this, but back in the 1800s, there was different banks that would have different banknotes, and that basically different banknotes were sort of worth different things depending on the respective respectability, reputability of the institution or so forth. He compared this to Monty Python's Life of Brian when he's trying to escape the Romans and he's haggling over the price of a mask. And he says, no, that you have to say this mask is worth more and worth less. And he said, okay, fine. We agree it's six, and holds up a six bank note. Says, that bank's no good. That's no good. That's worth three. It's like, so he has to like to double the price. But basically that is effectively one of the long legal institutions of central banks is, on another flip side, is that is price stability, or what something else is called as market liquidity. You can transact without affecting the prices. It's, you know, but basically it enables that price stability to be there because of the fact it's based on the fiat currency, all those sorts
of things.
You've
got a single currency. It's there to make complicated things more simple. So we've talked a bit about fiat currency. We've talked about bank credit. The only requirement for bank credit is an ability of a customer's ability to return that money, and that the bulk of that money is going to be interest. And that's so that's a profit motive, which then becomes a barrier between a customer and time shifting their spending decisions. This has impacts on society in a huge way, because if you're not credit worthy, then you miss out.
I mean, and basically it's deciding the worthiness of an individual, right? Like, I mean, think of it in that way.
You start building classes in society.
So
this becomes part of a class structure. And we've talked something about the hierarchy. We're going to have a break. We're going to come back to this conversation. We're going to talk about other things after this. So bear with us. Let's see where this conversation goes after the break. Good on you, Kent. You're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT.
At 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
And wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
Come to the Degrowth Festival on Sunday the 22nd of March from 11 a.m. till 7 p.m. Building community and resilience. Let's create the world we want by practicing it now together. Sing, dance, picnic under the trees, and check out the dozens of stalls, workshops and talks. The 2026 Degrowth Festival, Curtin Square, Carlton. Search for Degrowth Festival 2026 on Humanitix for more details and to register. The Degrowth Festival is a 3CR supporter.
America is waiting for a message of some sort or another. We'll be right back.
You're on Radio M&T with Kent and Kevin this week. We've got Kent in. We've been talking about banking. That was Brian Eno and David Byrne. Your suggestion, Kent.
It was, yes.
America is waiting, and it's this is from ages ago. It was 19
I think it's like 40 years ago or something. We had a conversation about David Byrne, and I was sad that I missed him recently.
Yeah.
I heard from Neighbors and so forth. And you mentioned this album.
Yeah,
and I was like, oh yeah, that was a damn good album.
Yeah, yeah. So America is waiting for a message
of some sort,
of some sort to head it in the right direction.
It hasn't changed.
I think it missed the message. It's
still waiting for it.
Look, I'm just going to say this about Trump. I reckon Trump is the most honest U.S. president the U.S. has had because
invading Iran for
He says I'm going to go kidnap the president of Venezuela and steal their oil. Whereas previous presidents would go, oh, there's disruption in Venezuela and we need to blah, 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 and that's most credible and other stuff. So because he's been so blunt.
This is a topic we could have for another show.
This
is the evolution of, I think, a lot of U.S. policy that's been neoliberal and imperialist and has extracted from, and dominated economically from the rest of the world and
These are the champions of capitalism, and they very much intertwine.
No disagreement on that.
this is what we're talking about, banking and capitalism and profit. We digress. So we've been talking about banking, and we've been discussing that commercial banks have an arrangement with the Reserve Bank of Australia. The Reserve Bank of Australia is the government's bank, and their job is to help people time shift their spending operations so that they can buy things that they otherwise mightn't be able to if they had to save up for them. Therefore, there's an obligation there for them to act in the public good. But we don't see that reflected in banking operations.
Can I read something to you on that point?
Sure.
Okay. And this is, you'll get a kick out of this because you're on that point from the actual Reserve Banking Act when it was brought into existence in 1959. It said it is the duty of the Reserve Bank Board within limits of its power to ensure that monetary and banking policy is directed to the greatest advantage to the people of Australia. And that skip to the next section. This is section 10 for any legal sort of nuts out there. In the opinion of the Reserve Bank Board will best contribute to stability of the currency, maintenance of full employment in Australia, and the economic prosperity and welfare of people of Australia.
But only some people of Australia. If you're a profitable person of Australia, then the bank will look after you. The bank is there for you.
Yeah.
If you're not, you're on your own.
And it's like Dirty Dancing. I think it said some people matter and some people don't. Apparently
yes.
Said ironically from a quote from Ayn Rand. So anyway, yeah. Or not.
So what we have here is an institution, the banking institution, which is set up as an intermediary between the population and credit. Correct me if I'm wrong. If I take out a loan from the bank, essentially what I'm doing is time shifting my my spending operation. And because if I had to save up all the money, the fiat currency, the money that was spent into the economy via the government, if I had to save up to buy everything with that, it would take too long. And so the banks advance me that money. And then as I acquire fiat currency in the future, I can repay that loan. Fiat currency that is introduced into the economy, I have to access that in some shape or another in the future to satisfy my ability to repay that loan, or certainly the interest on that loan. And therefore, there's a requirement for governments to keep on spending into the economy, running deficits, to create an amount of money that people can access so that they can repay their loans to the bank. Is that generally speaking?
Yeah, it's in the ballpark. Yeah.
It's in the ballpark. I know that there's a whole...
For people interested out there. And I think it was Minsky who said, if you look at a balance sheet, if you can't prove it on a balance sheet, you can't prove it. I think we'll spare everybody trying to describe
that. We're not
that
going to go on a balance sheet. I'll tell you. Yeah,
that will be dangerous.
Balance sheets is like the academic proof. That's the academic proof. If you need the academic proof, go find an academic. Kent, you're an academic.
Almost, Kevin.
And run them. Well, yeah. You're in the process. And they can run you through the balance sheets. They just confuse the hell out of
it. One thing, and it is very confusing. I mean, this is where it gets very tricky because, to bring up a point of Steve Keen, who is talking about, the issue of private debt. One thing I'll throw at you, I mentioned a credit card earlier, or one of these awful buy now, pay later schemes, which are finally have been put into the Prudential Regulatory Act. They weren't previously,
right?
Because they weren't technically interest. It was you were breaking a contract if you didn't repay it. But to basically have a line of credit is such that's, again, like you're saying, it's something you don't have as a deposit in your current savings account, let's say. But then, as Steve Keen says, the point here is credit is demand. I mean, that does translate into a real good or service.
Right.
If you went online, wanted to buy something, if you like to get some clothes online or something like that, and you know, these awful like buy now pay later schemes or something like that, you could. It so, didn't have it. That's another. I mean,
so you're generating activity. Credit, well, sure. of course, credit is generating activity. That's the whole point of it is to make purchases ahead of time, and that has to require some activity. The issue that we might want to discuss here is that if you have this intermediary as a bank, which is the operation which enables people to time shift their spending decisions, and these banks are profit driven. And are trying to seek ways to extract surplus value out of anything they possibly can. Is that the right vehicle to be in charge of this fairly responsible service that they're providing? And in particular, okay, so there's the straight credit operation where they just do a loan, but they also get involved in all sorts of investment opportunities and finance schemes, speculative stuff. Is it right to have organisations that are speculating and profit-driven as the vehicle for which to help people spend in the public good?
No. Let me think about that for a minute. You know, we're coming back and describing all of this banking, right? It is really important to actually understand how this works. Like, I wouldn't call them the intermediaries because that's the neoclassical myth, right?
Always happy to be corrected, Kent.
That's cool.
That means I'm learning.
But yes, but no, just to sort of put that point out, because they are an institution that can enable credit and therefore can create demand, right? And they can do that endogenously when it is needed and or desired. Now, what the sort of arguments against this are, and these interestingly come from the left and right, from we, you know, want to move, quote unquote, move beyond money or something like that on the left or something like that. And then you could have on the other side, like libertarians or, you know, people who are engaged in crypto wanting to, quote, go back to like peer-to-peer, like intermediation, which we said at the start of the show, never existed.
There's never been a basis of an economy.
There's still massive issues because, yes, these banks are still like wanting to expand, grow. I come back to somebody I think is a bit unsung hero in the post-Keynesian. He's also a Marxist as well. Is late Fred Lee, you know, and I've taken a lot of stuff, but basically
who's that?
Fred Lee was a post-Keynesian and institutional, and also, you know, I don't know what, you know, Marxist camp he falls into.
Yeah.
But of course, he actually built a model of understanding of how, I mean, all of other organizations, firms operate it, and banks, that basically this is going to be how they reproduce over time. And back to your point, yes, I mean, an institution like this that does not have as its central policy goal well-being of people, the planet, social justice, equity, all that stuff, what's their interest? Like, I mean, it's not that difficult, right?
Yeah.
But so basically the issue is it's not about we need to limit the capacity, whack down endogenous money. That's been with us throughout our entire human history.
Yeah.
Yes, it's in these sort of specific terms, but we need to make actually the right policy goals, because what happens is, especially after like the GFC in the States and so forth, and Obama's very lackluster response to that, which lost, I mean, certainly that was when I was there and I lost all hope in him, and because he just gave it to Wall Street. He catered to Wall Street, right? But basically it's like, how can we actually restrict credit and speculation to, let's say, fossil fuel companies who want to get investment from all sorts of institutions to build fossil fuels off the coast in WA that are destroying our First Nations precious, should be UNESCO, not yet, but heritage rock art. Do we want to sort of limit acquisitions and mergers that these institutions do to gain power? Because you're right, because like it's speculation, there's then like what happened in the GFC, you know,
we talked to the previous shows, we went right through the GFC, and you saw what happens when a financial institution is driven by profit and the manipulation and the distortions that they cause and the eventual collapse. Nothing's been learnt from that, you know. We're now in the same world, and those same situation could and probably will happen again.
And possibly, depending on, you know, the fact that we have not transitioned to a renewable energy source dependent. You know, all of our agricultural machinery is, well, diesel.
Yeah.
You know, it was an awful illegal invasion going on.
Yeah.
By, I would call, the Epstein regime.
Yeah.
That basically, yep. that now is that basically it's going to, and this is food supply. We're talking about like critical essentials that are run on oil.
So we've got plenty of examples of how the system as it currently runs, which is a profit-driven system, can go horribly wrong. We've seen it in the GFC. We've seen it in the Great Depression. We see it all the time. Hmm. There could and should be a better way of managing this. And I'm interested in what happened in 1949 when Chifley tried to nationalise the banks. And my understanding of that was that Chifley, after World War II, understood the currency-issuing power of the Commonwealth, of Australia, and how the government can use its fiscal capacity to enable enormous change, and that there's a government responsibility in that. If it was driven by private enterprise, you might end up with all the sorts of distortions we've seen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think you've got some ideas about
I have some ideas.
Democratic Kev, finance?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, well, thanks for asking, Kev.
Yeah.
and I need to refresh my history on the 1947-49 Chifley Curtin, because basically proposing nationalizing the banks. You know, mentioned before, like, that basically these institutions are... they are profit-driven, yes. I mentioned that notion, the going concern, earlier, because we want to have a basic level of well-being, but that, of course, we need money. We need state money, fiat currency, public money, to be able to, you know, make sure that we can clear our accounts. You know, you and I have enough savings and all this sort of stuff. So let's take this completely out of a profit incentive.
Driven model, right. Yeah.
And this is basically, and, you know, I'm part of an... helped co-found the Public Money, Public Good group, and yep. which we've done some, I know you spoke on the show before, and
yeah. Yes. But so if we had nationalized the banks, and if we've reduced the role of bank to basic banking operations, we take away...
Make banking boring again.
Yeah, yes. Make banking boring again. Because essentially the private banks have a relationship with the Reserve Bank of Australia. Without which they couldn't exist.
Exactly, yes.
So they are, in essence, an extension of the RBA, of public money.
That's what the argument comes to. Yeah.
So if you strip back the profit motive for banks and you made them an instrument, an institution, that's simply helped people.
A public servant, perhaps.
Provide a public service where they could credit check somebody and they would say to that person, I'd like to borrow $100,000. They would then calculate the repayment of that, scrapping a huge amount of the interest, which is the profit motive of the bank, saying that yes, this person can borrow $100,000. We'll factor in some appreciation, some inflation, etc.
It would be like a fraction of what we, you know, you would it'd be minimal. I mean, what we haven't talked about a bit is how
compound
interest rate
is a bitch. It's just keeps on biting. It doesn't seem like that much, but it keeps on. It will turn a $100,000 loan into a $320,000 repayment over time. You know, and the rest of it's interest. That's how banks make their money. If the institution that is lending the money is not driven by profit, but is in fact an extension of the Reserve Bank of Australia, and I don't know enough about the 49 Chifley government, but I think that's
the idea. And another idea that's been put out there, I believe it's Raul Carrillo who does this as well. I thought Rowan Gray was part of this as well, but basically, like, that there's other movements that call for basically digital cash. This sounds controversial, but have an account at the Reserve Bank, and just basically it is a digital form of cash, and, you know, very pro cash. And I think there's a movement out there that does get taken away. It can sort of veer a bit into the some wrong sort of conclusions about what cash is and so forth, but it's something that is actually that we should be able to have. And that's another sort of argument for this democratic finance. I mean, basically it's making finance public. It is making it public money. I mean, it is public money.
Money is public money. It's
hoarded by these, in this sense right now, it's the best example, right? Because it's a private bank that is basically restricting access and making a punitive repayment schedule of, in fact, public money.
Yeah. Here's the real rub, is that, as we've described, and if you want to go back through the previous episodes, all money is government money. It's public money. And all that the private institutions do, they don't create the money. They use the money and they hoard the money. They collect the money. So to see an institution like a bank whose primary role is to help with the distribution of money through an economy, through its citizens, to access the things that they need, like cars and houses and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. To see an institution like that actively work against it by hoarding the money that they're supposed to be distributing and trying to achieve profits, etc., is counter to their purpose in many ways. And I keep on finding this again and again, which is why I'm turning into a raving socialist these days, Kent.
Jeez, Kevin, that's
it just keeps on sharpening my focus. We've been told for years that the private market is the best way to achieve advancements. Mm. Well, the private market, the profit motive, is the best way to motivate your economy. And yet, what we keep on finding is that the profit motive is the best way to sabotage your economy.
To make
life harder for people and to create a system where you have elites and the ruling class.
It reinforces class hierarchies and expands them. And Piketty's famous work of the wealth that's growing exponentially. Had sort of dipped our toe in the legal aspect of this. Excellent book by a woman named Katerina Pastor, who talks about the code of capital. This could not happen. This accumulation of wealth could not happen with the legal framework. And that's another thing that's sort of involved in this as well, of course. And if we, enough of us to demand that there could be public money, a democratic finance system, that we could then wrestle this away back from a profit-sinking institution, which is bound by law, of course, that there have been kickbacks, but you're right. Like, this is a firm's, including a bank, the interest is to be a going concern, is to grow power, profit, and expand over time. And that is not like you take it back to what's a policy goal. Like, if I'm starting to do a project or something, I'm just like, what's the main purpose here?
The purpose has been lost. The whole purpose of money and the public good has been lost. It's lost in the profit motive. Look, Kent, we could it's enough to drive you to drink, which is what we're doing at the end of the month when we go and have a beer. People might think that we go to the pub and we discuss academics. No, we just sit there and cry into our beers about the state of the world.
commiseration and solidarity.
Hey, Kent, look, it's been great having you on today.
I want to make one more plug.
One more plug.
And you played the promo for it for the Degrowth Festival. Anybody who is along the 22nd, not this weekend, next weekend, that's in Carlton, Curtin Garden, I believe. We will be there, public money, public good. We'll be there. We'll be doing a brief workshop on this, trying to keep it really simple. Our friends, too, Unionists for a Job Guarantee, want to throw out to them as well, will be there as well. I think they're doing a workshop. Their workshop's on at 3:15. That's Unionists for a Job Guarantee. 4:30, we're on public money, public good. But come have a chat, because what we want to do is create a get a lot of other people who care about education.
We're gonna go, Kent. We're gonna go.
Okay,
gotta go.
All right, come see us.
Great talking. See you later. Bye.
See ya. Bye.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/radio MMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTED.org, educating the masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, have you heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable fund?
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.